So, I often have said, and usually shock people, that I will take 12 funerals for every wedding I have to do. And usually it has to do with the way that the gospel gets proclaimed. Because at the funeral, I almost always get to proclaim the gospel. And at weddings, I don't really think it matters sometimes what in the world I say. And we confuse the gospel and the day and the event and what it all means. We had one woman who came. Now, thankfully, I wasn't, in my former congregation, I was not part of this because I was out of town and they had a family member who was a pastor and they were coming in to do this. But my administrative assistant came in and after I got back and she said it was a complete just craziness. They were taking they were like pinning flowers. I mean, they were just turning the altar into a table, and she went out and she told them they couldn't do that, and they didn't really want the green pyramids up. They wanted the white ones up, and our general stance was always sort of the season, but okay, we'll put the white ones up, but you can't have anything on the altar. And it just became this sort of large affair, and it really, I've never had to worry about photographers, but photographers can be a real pain in the butt, and they can really be right up in your face, and with the, and that's fine. But so I don't usually think at times that I can never really talk about weddings and the good news all at once. But here is Jesus being tested by the Sadducees, and it has to do with a marriage question. And I go, well, of course it does, because those are little troublesome problems. And we have the Sadducees, right? So just to set the stage, if you don't know, Sadducees are they were the ruling elite priestly class of Judaism. You had the Sadducees, you had the Pharisees, you had the Essenes out in the wilderness, where they were sort of the.
That's the Dead Sea Scrolls, no?
Dead Sea Scroll folk, yeah, and they were the the crazy people, right? I mean, if they, he might have been one of them. There were probably more sort of sects than we really know, but those were three main sort of categories. Pharisees, much more like Jesus. They were sort of the country pastors and not the ruling elite. And the Sadducees, their main two kind of the main thing, only the Torah was authoritative, and they did not believe there was any resurrection because there was no text in the Torah that spoke of the resurrection. It's kind of like the difficulties between Lutherans and Catholics when the Catholics want to talk about limbo and purgatory because they've turned to the deuterocanonical books, the apocryphal texts, and say, there's something that says it could be purgatory. And we go, but it's not in the Bible. It's in that other collection, not ours. And so it's an analogous sort of conversation there. The Sadducees come up to Jesus with this test for him, really not seeking to make any point about marriage, but just to point out the ridiculousness of the resurrection. But they bring up the question, using the law that was in the Torah, where if a man marries a woman and he dies and she has no child, then the brother, if there is one, marries her, and if they have, he's supposed to give her a child, and if he doesn't, it is the brother's child, not his child. But so they sort of make it absurd. Let's just go down the line. None of them have it. What do we do? Well, marriage is a very this-worldly thing that God gives us. And in a way, the Sadducees know that. I did have one rule when people would come to me and to get married and they'd want to write their own vows. I said two things. One, you actually have to promise something. It can't be just sort of an amorphous declaration of love. you actually have to promise something. It has to be bound in time. Until death parts us. For all of our days, however you want to write that. But it has to be limited in time. It ends, right? And briefly, just the way we understand marriage. Marriage is about, there's a procreative end, about the raising of families. It's not just about the swapping of genetic material. But there's a unitive end. There's as we live together, or a fidelity end, that we learn to be faithful to one another, we learn to be faithful to God. And then there's a sacramental end, which I am Lutheran. It is not a sacrament, but it is sacramental. It is about the practicing of forgiveness. It is about that relationship being a healing thing, not a divisive and hurtful thing. And that usually ends up in every wedding sermon that I give, and it's probably forgotten 2.5 minutes after I'm done. But all of those things, right, in a sense, none of those things are needed in the resurrection. The procreative end. God himself is the God of life and death. He will give us all life in that resurrection. There will not be a need for faithfulness, for what we have hoped for and what remains yet unseen will be fulfilled. And the sacramental presence, there will not need to be a place of healing and forgiveness, because we will have been healed and forgiven completely and utterly, raised to a new life. And so Jesus sort of lays that out. Essentially, you don't understand what you're talking about, Sadducees. You're still thinking in terms of that life as if it's just an extension of this one, with a sort of a momentary pause in between. So he's not content with that, to just sort of say the children of the resurrection will not be given in marriage or will be married. But instead, goes further. It says, and just so we know that there is a place in Torah. He refers to the burning bush when Moses says, well, who are you? I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he does this really wonderful little twist. Says clearly, he didn't say he was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Because to him, they're not dead; they're living. Which raises some interesting, I think, some temporal questions. But we don't need to get into them here. But the sense of even our sense of time and structure are called into some thinking there that will puzzle us, I'm sure. But there in the resurrection, it is a life that we are told of, but that we must speak of forever in mystery. We did gather last week. We talked about All Saints Sunday. We talked about those congregations that had the half circle as the altar rail that continue around the back, you know, sort of that sort of celestial around the back side of that in the Eucharist. We know we will be gathered. We know that we will be in God's presence, that it will be that sense that holds us to that. Faithfulness of God reaches for us beyond the bounds of death. God has brought an end to sin in the death of Jesus. Not that he keeps us from necessarily from sinning, but he ends its power as a permanent good, or permanent end. And he reaches beyond that. We need not fear that end, and he pulls us into that. We can make no promises that go beyond that. As much as we feel it, we cannot make any promise to love forever. But our God is the one God who may reach beyond time and space to pull us back into a glorious fellowship. For us, it seems perhaps absurd, for it is hard to see beyond this life and this time. But the fact that we do at times feel like it could go on and on and on, I don't want to necessarily throw out the "I will love you forever" moments, for I think it points us to that idea that something can transcend death. And I think it is rooted in God's very character, that it is the God who loves us. That love reaches beyond, so that our love for him and for others might ultimately continue. Thanks be to God. Amen.